You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. It's 10 years since Beppe Grillo began his journey from comedian to politician. Has he accomplished anything beyond a blurring of the distinction? My guests Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, Matt Alagaya and Chiara Ramella will be discussing that and the day's other big stories, including Australia's gun amnesty, which has reaped an encouragingly yet terrifyingly bountiful harvest, the revelation of the best place to live as an expat, put the champagne on ice, North Korea, and how to become a famous war photographer without going to war, taking any photographs, or indeed existing. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, Matt Alagaya and Chiara Ramella. Welcome all. We will start in Australia, the streets of which are safer to the tune of about 26,000 unregistered firearms, all handed into police as part of a nationwide gun amnesty. Prize exhibits have included such picturesque antiques as an 1850s Beaumont Adams revolver, Lee Enfield rifles brought home from World War I, and a homemade machine gun. The haul amounts to perhaps a tenth of the illegal weapons in circulation in Australia. The amnesty runs until the end of the month. Andrew, first of all, it's often said that hard cases make bad law, that you shouldn't react to bizarre freak events with, you know, crowd-pleasing legislation. But this kind of is that, and it does kind of work. The backstory here is that this is the first gun amnesty since 1996, which followed the Port Arthur massacre when 35 people were killed by Martin Bryant. It's kind of a success, isn't it? 26,000 guns off the streets.
Definitely. So here in the UK, we had the Dunblane massacre, where we had a similar amnesty for guns afterwards. And it's understood that actually removing guns just takes away that. Many crimes happen in a moment, in an instant, when somebody grabs something and is angered and fires a gun. That's how many. They're not often contemplated. They're not often thought out. They're often, you know, moments of sudden reaction. Now, if what's available is, you know, a baseball bat, maybe you'll get a broken jaw, but if what's available is a gun, you may end up dead. I just looked at the numbers before we came on. What's interesting also is, you know, that this is not just about murder. You know, if you also think about the number of people that get killed or kill themselves in suicides with guns. So in Canada, during one period when they had very few people being shot, they had some 5,000, in a 10-year period, they had 5,600 people who shot themselves with a gun. Now, what's interesting is, in the majority of cases where they interviewed people who had failed to kill themselves with a gunshot or who had changed their mind and taken pills, whatever, they said the decision-making process from deciding to kill yourself to picking up the gun was, on average, 5 minutes. So somebody is watching TV, they think, my life is shit, I'm going to shoot myself. Oh, there's a gun, I'm going to put the gun in my mouth and shoot myself. Now, if that gun isn't there, that 5 minutes, yeah, maybe you will take an overdose, or maybe you'll try and jump off a chair or something, but it's more likely that you'll fail. So it's the removal of that gun from that moment of anger or depression. It has a real impact.
Matt, is there even an argument against this that the most ardent, you know, American Second Amendment gun nut fan could mount? Because this is not an entirely voluntary handing in of implements. It's been made fairly clear that the severe penalties will attend any illegally held firearms after the amnesty. But is this potentially a way forward?
I think so. I mean, the only argument against it, as far as I can tell, is that actually your hardened criminals and the people who are part of organised crime, they don't use these amnesties and they don't give in their guns. But the argument against that is that if there are fewer guns out there, then hardened criminals find it more difficult to steal them, for instance. They can't get their hands on them quite as easily as if there were, you know, loads lying around people's houses. So I can't really see a good argument against it. And I do think the fact that, you know, 26,000 guns have been handed in, that can only be a good thing for the country to have that many fewer in the country.
They do estimate, Tom, that 10 times that number are still in circulation. This is illegally held weapons. And I know because I have friends in Australia who are gun owners because they are hobby shooters or hunters or whatever, that the regulations attending them are incredibly tight. Like, they, police do launch surprise inspections of your house to see if your weapon is appropriately secured, etc. And if it's not, then you're in real trouble. Again, stories like this, do they just remind us of how strange and singular America is on this front?
Well, I mean, I kept wanting to, from what everyone was saying, I kept wanting to talk about America because that's the obvious place to go next, where not only is there no question of an amnesty, it's very difficult to even see more advanced gun control. And there is that Second Amendment question, which, as you said, means that it's an almost impossible issue to touch. But what I find funny is exactly you mentioned there, hunters, the sort of frontiersman mentality. I mean, presumably there are people in Australia, which was for so long a sort of frontier town country, who required weapons for their safety or for their survival or and this sort of thing. And yet it's a country that's been able to reconcile that with the more pressing requirements of a functioning democracy where people's safety is guaranteed and where the law acts to protect everybody. And it seems that this is being implemented without that much controversy. And of course, then you look at the United States, where you have open carry laws in so many states, where people who may have psychiatric problems can carry guns, younger people. And you just, exactly to pick up what Andrew said, you realise how crazy it is and what an abuse and what a wanton misreading of that amendment of the Constitution, of that constitutional right, it is to persist in this idea that it is a fundamental human right to be armed to the teeth.
Can I just give you two more numbers which to add to the mix, which just show you the why it's just good not to have guns around, you know, when they're not being used for, you know, hunting or shooting, all the things you want. So in 2010, 19,392 Americans committed suicide with a gun in 1 year. In the same year, 14,000 people accidentally shot themselves. Now, that's just taking those guns out. That's just the medical bills, the stitching together of people, of lives maimed, of people's feet shot off, all of that. That's all just through accident, through having a gun around. And that's the thing that I think that gets lost in this debate. And I think that, you know, it's funny you mentioned in the headlines, you know, antique rifles and being handed in. Somehow, that's always the headline in all these things. People focus on the nutty guns handed in. And Matt was right. Maybe in some instances, it's not the guns in the hands of active criminals that get handed in. But maybe it is the gun that's in a tough neighbourhood where someone thinks, you know what, I used to be involved in crime, I don't want to be anymore. That gun gets also handed in. That actually does begin to change crime statistics. So the removal of the weapons, I think, is an important thing.
Okay, well, let's move along now slightly and take a look at Italy, where the Five Star Movement is celebrating the 10th anniversary of its initial primordial stirring. That was the so-called V-Day rally held in Bologna in 2007. Since then, Five Star has done much to inculcate in Western electorates the idea that a career in professional attention-seeking is a suitable background for holding high electoral office. So thanks for that. It's going brilliantly. Chiara, Five Star now, 10 years on the one hand, it has been a fairly remarkable story. You know, they have succeeded according to their own, I guess, judgment and ambitions, etc. But are they kind of a busted flush at this point? Have they peaked? The local elections in June were not, by and large, good for them.
It depends how you want to look at it. If you want to look at it from the point of view of how they're polling right now, they're definitely not over. Because at the moment, they're polling at the highest number in Italy. I mean, a survey that came out just in today's Repubblica puts them at 28%, which is like over the PD, so the ruling party at the moment. if you think about what their mission has become, then perhaps there is an argument to say that they may have outlived themselves, in as much as they were born as a movement, really, not even a party, that seeked to remain outside the political spectrum because it was so anti-political spectrum, and then eventually had to enter the fray in 2009, kind of really entering elections as well. And nowadays, they really have become essentially a party that functions within the systems of the political spectrum of Italy, and therefore have had in some way to betray their original intentions.
But just to follow that up, Chiara, over that 10 years, have they got to the point where a significant plurality of the Italian public, regardless of what people tell opinion pollsters, do people look at Five Star and think, that is an alternative apparatus of government? That is something I can seriously imagine happening.
Well, you do have five-star movement mayors in certain cities, and they may not be doing the best jobs. And we know that Virginia Raggi has incurred a lot of criticism, both for her practical ability to solve very practical issues like the issue of rubbish, for example, on the streets of Rome, but also with her cabinet. It's very chaotic. But they have moved into actual positions of power over the last 10 years. And If you look at the fact that, you know, obviously the regional elections last time didn't go very well, the communal elections, the municipal elections, but now in 2 months' time we will have the Sicilian elections, which many people are taking as very symbolic as to what is going to happen in the general elections, and they have a serious case for winning there. They've always had quite easy game in Sicily, because Sicily is a strange region where there's always been a bit of a non-convincedness about traditional party models. But I think they have a chance there, and that proves that people also take them into consideration when it comes to local government.
And I guess, Andrew, the interesting thing is they rose to prominence at a time when you had a toupee trouser dropper like Berlusconi running the nation. So that was formal politics. That was, you know, that was the politics of the system. And for many Italians, they looked at that and they thought, we have a crazy man who surrounds himself with, you know, people of, you know, dubious backgrounds, and, you know, women whose kind of idea of formal dress is putting on a pair of pants, maybe. And that was the kind of thing he surrounded himself with. He so when other people were in cities thought, you know, do you know what? I would like my city to run a bit better. I would like to have some access to the way that power is. You know, Beppe Grillo didn't just seem like a chance to change politics, but it also seemed a chance to kind of, like, you know, give the system a bit of a kicking. And I think that even today in Italy, when you meet many Italians, it's like, okay, we have a great company, we're doing super well, but don't go to the city and ask for anything, or don't ask the state for anything. It's still seen as chaotic. And many, you know, I think grown-up, successful Italians still feel, God, actually this system needs, you know, a real boot up the backside. And that's what he is, I think.
Tom, we have heard quite a bit in various constituencies from the kick the system up the backside tendency. Hasn't quite a lot of it ended up in practice being rather an argument for the idea that maybe there was something to be said for the system?
Well, yeah, I think it comes back to a more fundamental question, which is, and this is a narrative we hear in this country, what is the point of being in politics if not to try and effect meaningful change? And people bandy that criticism at Jeremy Corbyn of Labour, of course, saying, great, it's wonderful that you stick to your ideology, but if it a de facto effect of that is that you will never get into office and never put any of those theories to test, then what's the point? What's interesting about Five Star Movement is that, as Kira says, they have tested the water provincially in mayoralties, and, you know, you asked, have they been successful? The polling numbers suggest that people regard them as a credible option. I guess the broader question is, if you are an anti-establishment, viscerally anti-establishment campaigning movement before even you're a party, what happens when you become mainstream 10 years in? You're regarded as an option. Do you not have to then adapt further and begin to reflect people's concerns about getting things done? Is it acceptable, for example, if Five Star Movement insists that they won't go into coalition with certain parties because it's against their principles? Don't they owe it to a public that is backing them to try and deliver effective effective politics, even if it means compromising with some of their principles.
And Kjarkin talked this better than me, but you know, that certainly when you know, Renzi was you know, having troubles, you know, there were certain times when he just needed them to kind of do the right thing, and they often did deliberately the wrong thing just because it kind of went against their principles of you know working with anybody. And the Italian system, the Italian state, could have been better if they'd on some occasions gone along with him, I think.
Definitely. And I think the problem with the elections that we will see next year is that even though they're polling so highly, in order not to betray their fundamental principle, which is to refuse categorically any alliance with anybody else, we will probably see the continuous return of the same situation in Italian politics, which is they probably won't be able to make it, given that they're still discussing a new electoral law. It means that probably somebody will need to make an alliance when time comes. They won't be wanting to make any, so the other parties will have to, and we'll probably end up with a situation which is unchanged and ultimately defeats the point of all of the change-making movements that we've tried to see over the last few years. So it's difficult because they end up being, they probably will paradoxically end up being a conservative force, whether they do at their best or not.
Just a final quick thought on this, Chiara. Where have Five Star got to from the, I guess, on the spectrum between where a lot of these organisations start out with the, as Groucho Marx would have put it, whatever it is, I'm against it, to actually coming up with a constructive and positive vision of government?
I think the one thing that's been one of their main points from the very beginning was to try and reduce the pay of the parliamentary staff, so the MPs, and the number of them as well. And given that last year's referendum for Italy, which is what made the headlines around the world, has failed eventually, they're trying to make a new parliamentary reform now, and they're trying to push those points again. So that message, which is basically what they were born with, is still very much alive and quite unresolved. Still, which also goes back to the point of the fact that maybe they are still really very much relevant 10 years on. Just they've had to be absorbed by the system in order to be doing so.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tom Edwards, Chiara Ramella, Andrew Tuck and Matt Alagaya. Do stay tuned.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemate sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things. And it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, Chiara Ramella and Matt Alagaya. If you are listening to this in Portugal and thinking of leaving the country for a new life elsewhere, the next item won't help you. If you're listening anywhere else and thinking the same thing, however, you should probably go to Portugal before our Portuguese listeners put their rent up. The new survey by Expat Outsider says that Portugal has the best quality of life in the world, topping a poll of expats ahead of Taiwan, Spain, Singapore and the Czech Republic. I will ask the table at large, do I hear a dissenting opinion?
I don't think so. I think we're all fans of Portugal in this building, and that probably won't be a surprise to anyone who reads the magazine or listens to the radio.
And I think, you know, for expats, it's a fascinating place. So it, you know, at the moment, there's a confluence of events that have made Portugal a very magical place, because, you know, all around the Med there are countries which are struggling with terrorism, with all sorts of attacks. Portugal, touch wood, has remained very peaceful. So if you're thinking of buying a holiday home, maybe in Tunisia or a Riyadh,
is that a big market, timeshare in Riyadh?
I don't know. Or buying a little kind of place in Marrakesh, then you're probably thinking you'll head to Portugal. The nature of the Portuguese is that they've gone out in the world, and they are very used to people coming in and going out. They don't see foreigners in a difficult way. Most people speak English. You know, regular people in a shop will be able to speak to you in English. So for an expat, it's easy to fit in. It's affordable. It's not kind of off the scale like trying to move to London or Paris. Child friendly, great food. So it's got all these kind of things that are kind of working
here.
Well, you do wonder. I was actually in Lisbon by some fluke, not as an expat, last weekend. And, you know, there is a receptiveness to outsiders. Even, you know, even a busy kind of touristy city like Lisbon, people don't seem bored of outsiders like they are elsewhere. There's just a kind of an openness which is fascinating, and I think that's why expats like it.
Chiara, you are, of course, actually an expat. You are
indeed.
One of two of us at this table. What can a place do to make itself more like Portugal, that is, more sort of amenable and agreeable to expats?
Well, provided that I don't think we can do an awful lot about London's weather or food, although, you know, obviously London's food scene has not to be snubbed at. I was in Portugal quite recently as well, and I must admit that going back to Andrew's point about different southern kind of European countries having some degree of shared characteristics, but also naturally a lot of differences. At this point in time, I think I would probably prefer moving to Portugal than I would back to Italy. And I think it's got to do with, the openness that Andrew mentioned, the feeling of willingness to engage with newcomers, to be excited about the prospect of something else coming in, which at the moment I don't really feel in Italy, and also a sense of progression, of look to the future, which I again is not something that necessarily I experience when I go back to Italy.
Matt, would Portugal tempt you, or would, I mean, I think, okay, I'll ask another question, because I think we seem to be pretty much agreed that Portugal's quite nice. I will add my own few escudos in the old money worth here and say, yeah, I've been there and Lisbon seemed perfectly pleasant, and I've been to one of the Azores, which is to say an Azore, and yeah, nice, perfectly nice pleasant. Mm. Weather was shocking the weekend I was in the Azores, so there was that. But other than Portugal, Matt, where might tempt you?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Not that we're trying to get rid of you.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very interesting question. I mean, generally, if you're looking to leave the UK, you'd be looking for sunshine. Lots of people seem to end up in Australia, where you come from, obviously. I mean, I think Portugal is that place that, you know, you'd go to Italy, but you'd be slightly worried that the bureaucracy would grab you.
It does, without fail.
Or you, yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I can't think of anywhere that I'd rather go apart from Portugal. But there was one thing I wanted to touch on, which is that my brother is an expat in Copenhagen, and he said that, you know, even though, as we were saying, everyone in Portugal speaks English, everyone speaks English in Denmark as well, but there isn't quite the same friendliness there. And I think he was saying that the kind of the reverse side almost of the hygge movement and everyone being very cozy in their own house is that you don't actually get invited into that world as an expat.
I think in
Portugal you do.
The other key difference is that in Portugal, as opposed to Denmark, there's that thing of not bursting into tears every time the waiter brings you the bill, which is an issue in Denmark.
Help. I did just a survey today, actually, which is saying that if you want to make friends as an outsider in a new country, Sweden is the worst. And this was in a Swedish newspaper. They were saying that actually Swedes are just not very good at making friends with new arrivals. Yeah, all sorts. Which, you know, and that's, I think, the strange thing. So when I was in Portugal the weekend, you know, whether it was the guy driving the taxi or the guy who owned the hotel, I was having these conversations about, you know, tourism and what people felt. And there wasn't one person who said,
oh, you know, it's too much. You know, the taxi driver's opinion was, it's great, I get to speak my English. You know, I really like the mix of people I get. The restaurant owners were the same, like, yeah, it's great having local people, but it's really great meeting all these people from around the world who are interested in our country too.
Well, finally tonight, at some point in the last few years, you may have been moved, entranced and or outraged by the work of Brazilian war photographer Eduardo Martins, whose images from Syria, Gaza and Iraq have graced the pages of the Wall Street Journal, Le Monde and The Telegraph, among many others, and attracted a large and devoted audience on Instagram. Martins has now been unmasked as a fraud, although it may say something about our times that, unusually for a scandal of this sort, the images were more or less real, but the photographer was fake. As far as it's possible to tell, he doesn't exist at all. Andrew, as a magazine editor and before that a newspaper editor, how sure can you be of the credentials of any Yahoo who emails you saying, I have a story, which was, of course, how I got a job?
Well, first of all, when people get caught out by these things, I have some sympathy because, you know, you build up relationships with journalists and with photographers, which carries with it a level of trust. And you put your integrity slowly on the line over time as you give people more and more leeway to report and to tell stories. Now, you're relying that they're going to quote people fairly, that they're going to actually have met the people they're quoting. But, you know, people again and again have been caught out for taking shortcuts. Now, this isn't a guy taking shortcuts. This is some kind of fantasist who found people's images, flipped them so they were harder to trace, added himself into pictures, added another guy who's a surfer who he pretended to be him into pictures. So the whole thing was complex, but it's also the nature of how news and news gathering has changed. You know, there is just so much of it now. And if you want a picture, you just go to a news website and you download the image you want and bang, it's in your paper. Now, it makes it much, much more tricky. Now, the other thing is, you know, that this is an extreme example, but I do wonder, you know, the number of images we see coming back from war fronts, we don't know what is outside the frame. You know, that isn't cheating, that isn't fakery, but without a doubt, you know, most photographers are thinking about what they let you see in the image they provide. And you, in the old days, you'd see it on a contact sheet that things were outside the image that potentially changed the narrative. And we know that right back to Victorian times, there's an amazing photograph of the Crimean battlefields taken in the 1800s. And there's all these amazing cannonballs all along a road. And it's just a very celebrated photograph. But it was only in recent years that everyone's begun to think that the photographer, in a very early example of this, placed all the cannonballs there to make it a much better photo. And though, and also in some of the photography from the American Civil War, it's known that bodies were moved and things to make a better picture.
Chiara, what does it tell us that, I mean, it strikes me anyway that a lot of people who were gulled by this story were gulled not by the photos, because you can get images of war anywhere quite readily and easily on the internet especially. But people were taken in by the backstory, weren't they? The handsome byline photograph, this story that was confected about how he'd overcome leukemia as a child and sort of gone to war to broadcast the travails of the hard done by. People got totally sucked in by that, didn't they?
I think so, but I think it's also interesting to understand how, within the reflection on how news gathering is changing, what people then take to is the fact that this person feels real and it feels like this person was genuinely really there and was on the ground. And it's also, I think, relevant to understand that one of the main reasons why he was eventually caught out was the fact that people compared the pictures that he said he had taken with the accounts of people who actually had been there. And the real proof of the fact that he didn't exist came from the fact that these other photojournalists who genuinely were on the ground did not recall seeing him at all. So I think there's something to be said there about the fact that people are attracted to physical presence, to the actual presence of a journalist on the ground, and that is only that that actually uncovered him in the last instance.
Matt, very, very briefly, does this actually damage actual photographers and actual journalists, or can readers hopefully tell the difference and realize that, you know, the media gets scammed like any other, you know, industry get scammed occasionally.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's why I hope people think, and I hope this doesn't kind of add to a sense that the news is all fake and rubbish. I hope that there is actually some kind of order in this, and people think, okay, no, everyone can get scammed, and actually this was brought up, this was kind of revealed through proper fact-checking.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guests, Matt Allagaya, Chiara Mella, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Daphne Karnesis and Sophia Armadi. Our studio manager was Josh Prince. There's music next at 1900, Marcus Hippie with The Menu. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.